Blog Talk Radio.
Monday, January the 12th. It's hard to believe that it's been a week already, and there has been a lot going on in this short week. If you're just joining us for the first time, my name is Susan Knowles. I'm the host of the Stand for Truth radio show. I'm a former practicing attorney, a licensed psychotherapist, an author, and a writer. And I welcome you here. We always have a lot to talk about. We have great guests on, and tonight is no exception. If you have any questions, you can call in at 347-205-9620. You can also, if you're in the chat room, just ask questions, and then I can ask the guest the question for you. Now, tonight we have with us Ryan Morrow, and I'm sure if you get any TV at all, you've seen him on all week. He's been extremely busy, and he's been covering the subject of Islam extremists all week long. He is a national security advisor, or analyst, I should say, for the Clarion Project. He's a frequent analyst on Fox News. He's been a consultant to a number of government agencies, adjunct professor, as far as I know, and something very interesting, he was hired at an early age, and I want to ask him about that when I bring him on, as a geopolitical analyst. He has a master's in political science. He's made over 1,000 appearances on radio and TV, and what makes me like him so much is the fact that in 2012, the Muslim Brotherhood tweeted that he was delusional and a scaremonger. So welcome, Ryan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm glad that you're here. I wanted to ask you, now, I thought this was something, you know, as a psychotherapist, I guess I want to ask you this question. I see here, you know, at age 16, can you tell us about that when you were a geopolitical analyst? What was that all about, and how did you even get involved in something like that at such an early age?
It's a little hard to explain because there's no explanation for it. Basically, I just got obsessed with the topic when I was at a very young age. My parents were not political at all. I could actually name the Middle Eastern countries before I even knew who was running for president in 2000. I just did not care, and I still don't really care too much. And once I got my first computer, which was years after everyone else did, I started researching what was going on in Iraq, because the Clinton administration was bombing Iraq for the same reasons that President Bush later did. And I just got obsessed with the topics and the multi-layers of it, and I just hyper-focused on it. And part of the reason is that I'm blind in one eye, which I was very angry about, and it was a source of insecurity about when I was growing up. But it turned out to be the best blessing ever for me.
Wow.
Because as a result of that, I couldn't do what the other boys were doing, which was playing sports all the time. I couldn't talk about sports because I didn't care about it. And so I read and I wrote and I did research, and that was fun for me. And I eventually just got to a level where I had enough knowledge and enough thousands of pages of notes like a crazy person that when I met the right guy at the right time when I was 16 and he was forming a maritime security company, he hired me as an intelligence analyst or geopolitical analyst or whatever we called it from one day to the next because we couldn't quite figure it out.
Just a guy with a lot of knowledge at such a young age, right? Whatever the label is.
Yeah, and you know what? It worked for him because it gave his company attention, and he liked being able to say, hey, you've got to see the kid that's on my staff that works for me part-time. And so it ended up benefiting him because it really differentiated him from the field, and he's still a good friend of mine, and it's one of those things I still look back on and I say, how did this happen?
Wow, that's a very interesting. And how did you start or how did you get connected with the Clarion Project?
I was basically doing part-time work for this organization and then that organization, and as a result, it just kind of built my profile. And to make a long story short, they came in at the right time after I graduated and I was looking for a full-time place. And honestly, I mean, in terms of messaging and the cause, I couldn't have asked for a better partner. So when they came to me and they said, we'd like to discuss working with you, it was really a match made in heaven for both of us. And ever since, just every day has been exciting. Every day I get to wake up and I get to study what I love. And that's, you can tell by the product on clarionproject.org, how important that is, because a lot of freelance writers just get paid per article, so they have every incentive to just churn something out. What the Clarion Project wants me to do is study it intensively, and if that means I have only got one article for the week, as long as it shows that I studied that whole time, they're happy.
Wow, that is a sweet position there you have. That really is. Now, let me ask you a question before we get started and jump right into Islam. For people who may not be as familiar with the subject, you know, as you are, I know we hear often on radio and TV, we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, and then we talk about ISIS, and then we talk about Al-Qaeda. Can you kind of describe briefly the sort of the distinction between the three?
Well, if we want to first give basically a basic introduction to Islam, which I think is very important because it frames how you'll view the rest of these organizations, it needs to be understood that there is some diversity within Islam. It is one religion, but there's many different interpretations. And to be a Muslim, you basically have to testify that Allah is the one and only God, that the Prophet Muhammad was the last messenger, and then you're a Muslim. So there's a low bar to be considered a Muslim, and as a result, you have a lot of diversity in there. And what we're fighting against are those that have historically, over a long time, interpreted their faith as a political doctrine, a form of governance and civilization. And what ISIS and the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda and all these groups are doing is they have different methods towards achieving that objective, where they take Islamic law called Sharia, as interpreted by scholars, and they make it a form of governance Some of them say you can have elections within that framework. Some say you can't have elections at all. But the bottom line is that they view their faith as a form of governance, and that's what sets them apart from the more moderate Muslims that say, no, this is a faith. This isn't a form of governance.
And then in terms of how these people become, you know, radicalized in America and elsewhere, can you talk about how that happens? How do we get these people?
Sure, there's a few different ways that this happens. I mean, you have obviously the natural growth, but there's a huge proportion of the Muslim American population have immigrant parents and grandparents, and that's actually a very good thing. What mm-hmm. we find when we look at the survey data is that the immigrants who have come here are far more moderate, don't want their mosque to be involved in politics even to begin with, much less go into the Islamist ideology. And the younger generation, though, has a more politicized version of their faith. And that's where it starts. It starts with redefining the faith to these individuals, or introducing it to them if they're a new convert, and saying that this is a form of governance, that this isn't about going to pray five times a day. This is about having the perfect form of governance, and all forms of government, even ones that you think are good, are still imperfect and inherently unjust. So you may like America, but at the end of the day, Sharia is still a better form of governance, and you should fight for that. So that's the bottom, that's the common thread for all of this. What drives mm-hmm. them to actual acts of violence is a little bit different. That happens often very, very quickly. And it's usually not with people who have practiced Islam from a young age. It's usually with people who were non-religious, or they were Muslim in name only. And they decide, for whatever reason, they become more religious and they become fanatical about it. Their life changes, and so they're very dedicated to it. And the people around them craft their worldview as to how they see America and see the world, and then very quickly, sometimes in a matter of just 3 months, they will become radicalized and start contributing to violent jihad, even against the U.S. And that's what makes it so hard to detect, is that it happens so quickly.
And aren't these people usually the ones that become very radicalized? Aren't they kind of, alienated from society? And you had talked, I'd seen something, either a video of yours or an article that you'd done, talking about, you know, how they are sort of alienated and they have mentors and a redemption of sin. Can you talk a little bit about that, if you
sure.
remember?
There's a whole... I do. There's all sorts of different themes that are used to influence this worldview. One of them that I mentioned mm-hmm. is a Nazi-like anti-Semitism. Some of them, like Hamas, are explicitly genocidal. They believe that till the end of days they're going to be fighting and killing Jews. That's very close to the Nazi ideology. And then there's a softer version that says that there's this global Zionist Jewish conspiracy controlling the military-industrial complex, the U.S. government, the media, and they're all conspiring to control the world and oppress Muslims. And that's unfortunately a very widespread belief. So that usually is a very central part of the worldview in terms of sin. And this one's really interesting to me. And it helps explain why you can have evangelical Christians that are very, I don't want to use the word fanatical, but very overtly devout to their faith, but you won't have any acts of violence. And here's why. It's because mm-hmm. whereas in evangelical Christianity, they believe that by adopting Jesus into their life, that sin is wiped away. So it's an easy process. In Islam, especially Islamism, you have a very high bar to reach that no human can reach. You're going to fall very short. You're going to commit sin. You're going to drink alcohol. You're going to think little of someone, talk behind someone's back, whatever. All of these things, impossible to reach. And so radicals or people that are in the process of being radicalized are feeling a lot of shame and guilt. And they say, I want to go into paradise, but I've failed Allah. I keep failing over and over again. What do I do about this? And what a cleric or someone who's radicalizing them will say is, well, you have to do more good things than bad things. But how you quantify that? There's no security in that. There's no way to measure that. So what do they do? Well, there's one answer. If you die in violent jihad, in the process of jihad, at least, even if it's not violence, but you're financing them or something like that. That's the only guaranteed way to get into paradise and have all of your sin wiped clean. Usually when you talk to Americans, they assume someone won't be an Islamic religious radical if they are drinking alcohol or they're cursing or doing these other things. But actually, people that have that sinful lifestyle are more drawn to the concept of violent jihad because they have a greater desire to do something drastic to wipe away their sin.
Wow. That, and then it's hard to kind of deal with. You know, it's hard to kind of give them a different reason not to be that way then. You know, I mean, the only way they feel that they can be that way is to, you know, to redeem it sin through being a jihad, you know, from jihadist acts. So that, how do you counter that?
It's a very powerful argument. I would say that that's possibly the toughest argument that reformist Muslims run up against when they want to counter this stuff. The best way that they do it is that they characterize Allah as being more loving and forgiving than the jihadists will present, and the way the traditional interpretations of Islam present. So the reformers will say that you don't have to take those drastic measures. Allah created you with a purpose. He obviously cares about you. He wouldn't be involved in what's going on in the earth if he didn't care about you. And so these type of drastic measures are unnecessary, and they're also immoral. And then they'll argue why these specific acts of jihadist terrorism or other human rights abuses actually go against the faith. So that's what the reformists are up against, is that you have to – all of these threads are so closely connected that they have to go after the entire worldview. Oh, and you also mentioned the issue of assimilation, which is important. Mm-hmm. When you study members of Al-Qaeda, there's been exhaustive studies done. The most common denominator between them is that they are alienated from the societies in which they live. And sometimes that's self-imposed because they view Western culture as sinful and corrupt, and so they live in a bubble. And then sometimes it's they just haven't become part of society because of social reasons or whatever. They're just not accepted. And that's why it's very dangerous when I read about this small number of reprisal attacks against Muslims and mosques in Europe, because it creates that division and it creates that alienation where extremist ideology can really thrive.
Wow. Now, let's talk a little bit about what happened over in France. So what is your take on the whole thing about, you know, the attack on the newspaper in France?
I think it's being improperly framed. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In many different ways. The first way is that these jihadists would have just gone after something else. This wasn't about the cartoons. They went after the cartoons just because it was a high-profile target that would get a lot of attention and was a juicy target. If you're going to carry out an act of jihad, you're going to want to go after a soft target that's easy to go in and kill people and has really offended your ideology. And the cartoonists reached that bar, so then they became the target. So this wasn't really about the cartoons per se. And then secondly, it's also being framed improperly because it's not about being offended. When people get offended, they don't just lash out and start massacring people. That's not normal. That's a taught behavior. You have to be indoctrinated to respond that way. The objective of the attack in Paris was to force self-censorship in the West. Why? Because according to Sharia governance as pushed by Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and these other groups, these things are banned, but they can't conquer us. They can't institute blasphemy laws that prohibit the publication of such cartoons over us. So the only other way that they can make us conform to Sharia standards is by intimidating us, scaring us, so that we implement it upon ourselves. And that's exactly what happened. Because of the fear of attacks, you had all of the news networks censoring out the Muhammad cartoons, because they were scared of retaliation, and so the terrorist objective was achieved. We started basically instituting Sharia blasphemy laws upon ourselves.
Well, and we also, you know, we have a president who won't even talk about radical Islam, you know, and so I mean, that's sort of been his take all along. He doesn't want to talk about it, he doesn't want to name it what it is. And you know, I don't know, I'm sure you probably had a little time today to watch the White House press secretary, you know, unable to, that was agonizing to watch. I mean, he could not for the life of him say, you know, radical Islam, radicalized anything. And what I don't know if you noticed this, but what I noticed that he said, kept saying those were individuals who cited Islam as a reason for killing. He wouldn't even call them a group.
That's an interesting point. I haven't had anyone point that out. But yeah. So they're interpreting this as being essentially lone wolves. They want to downplay the significance of it because if you talk about it as being an attack by a group or a network, then that's something you have to confront more and you have to define it. Most importantly, but if you say, "Oh, well, these are the works of a few radicals, a few crazy people," then the imperative does not exist for a strategy and for you to describe the ideology.
Mm-hmm. Now, and in regards to also with the attack, I know the woman that was at the very beginning of the attack of the newspaper and the one, I guess, who allowed them past her, you know, for whatever reason, and they turned to her and said, you know, we're not going to kill you. And I know there were references that were made to Sharia law and they're not going to kill her because she's a woman, but she has to, you know, convert to Islam. And that was something that's even been left out in the press. From what I've read.
That was left out, even edited out. They also edited out the fact that the hostage takers were proselytizing because according to mainstream Sharia understanding, before you kill someone, if you have the opportunity to try to welcome them into Islam and spare their life, then you have to do that. You're sinning if you don't. And so because they were holding them hostage, they were required to preach the faith to the hostage takers and to everyone watching. And also they really love the platform, of course. Also was in accordance with Sharia. So it all always comes back to this idea of Sharia. And I should probably define that a little bit better because there's some misunderstanding. Sharia, when you say that to your average Muslim, they're thinking of praying five times a day. So the vast majority of Sharia isn't something to be concerned about. When it comes to governance, that's when it gets to be very, very problematic and frightening. So what is Sharia? It's not just Islamic law or the Quran. It's the Quran, the Hadith, which is the biographies of Muhammad, so Muslims can follow in his footsteps, some of which are credible and some of which are not. And then the third component, and this is the weak spot, is the interpretations of scholars from long ago. Sharia is largely man-made. It's the interpretations of fallible human beings. So what a Muslim reformer would say is, well, I don't have to accept those interpretations as being the equivalent of the Quran or the Word of God. I can make my own interpretations. If you say that up until recently in large parts of the Muslim world, you would be killed. That would be considered apostasy, an attack on the religion. But there is a growing movement, particularly by people like the Egyptian president, who are saying, no, Sharia can be questioned. These interpretations can be modernized. That's not betraying your faith. It's growing your understanding of the faith as humanity progresses. And that's a very, very positive trend that we're seeing.
Right. And you know, I want to touch on that a little bit later because that is important, and I think people need to hear a little bit more about what's going on. But I had, when we were talking about, you know, what happened in France, I read an article on your website today from the Islamist preacher Rahman, R-A-H-M-A-N, and basically, you know, he was porting the attacks on the newspaper and said that basically they can't expect a different result, and that he sort of blamed it on France and saying, you know, what happened in France is a war because they're doing the ethnic cleansing. So kind of turned everything back around and said the reason for the killings were because of the insulting Islam. You know, so it kind of is a little bit different than what you said, you know, of what their reasons really are. I mean, they talk about
it. It's part of the same thing. It would be the same thing because what the imam would be saying is that, all right, well, the attack happened because you're insulting Islam. That comes from the Sharia worldview, and because you're insulting Islam and that's so offensive, that's why it's banned. So he's speaking from a position of saying these type of things should be banned because they're so horrible, but they're not banned. So when they come out, then expect a violent response because they're allowed to be published.
Exactly. And it was interesting to read, too, that, you know, that he had been released on bail after being arrested for terror-related crimes. You know, so, I mean, here we go again. It's just like one thing after the other. Now, can you talk a little bit, too, about the anti-Semitism in regards to the kosher grocery store taking of the hostages there?
That goes back to the Nazi-like theme that I mentioned earlier. A lot of commentators will try to connect that to Israel and say, well, that's a repercussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They view Jews as being supportive of Israel and one with Israel, and so they're going after Jews. And that's not what it's about at all. Because this extremism and this Jew hatred existed before 1948 when Israel was established as an independent state. So what is this? It comes from the collective punishment of Jews, which is, again, rooted in historical Islam, which many Muslims may disagree with that, but it is part of Islam's history, as it is with other faiths, like my own Christianity. And it also has a lot to do with Hitler. It comes from the idea that the Jews are essentially one body, and the disagreements between them are very, very minor, and the Jews are inherently manipulative, selfish, cheap, imperialistic, and they're basically a horrible people that are genetically wired to try to conquer the world and control it through secret societies in order to oppress people and steal all of their resources. That's a theme that has existed in radical Islam for a long time, but then once Hitler got in the act, it really, really expanded. And it doesn't appear in any history textbook that I'm aware of, but the Nazis had a major operation in the Middle East. They had high-level Islamic clerics allied and working with them to push this type of Nazi propaganda into the Arab world, and that's why you're seeing these exact same themes slightly modernized today. So instead of saying Jew, they'll say Zionist. But it all comes down to the same idea that there's a secret Jewish network controlling all the societies that's preying upon innocent Muslims and non-Muslims around the world and manipulating everyone so that we all kill each other for their sake.
Well, can you also, I was surprised to learn at how many no-go zones there were in France and what the implications of having them there are. Can you tell people about what that means and what the implications are?
Right. This is a very disturbing trend that I think is going to be reversed in the coming months because of this attack. In France, there's over 750 of these sensitive urban zones, which can be as small as just a couple blocks. I know people who have been there. And sensitive urban zones is the polite wet term that the French government uses for no-go zones. These are high crime, high immigrant, Muslim majority areas in France that are hostile to outsiders, hostile to authorities. It doesn't mean that non-Muslims don't go there completely, but it's very limited and it's very risky. And the police and first responders are afraid to go in because of the hostility. So, for example, there's been a lot of riots in France because if the police have to arrest someone in there or they shoot someone, then everyone immediately starts rioting because they have this worldview that the police are just out to get them, and they don't view themselves as being under the authority of the French government. And in that environment, Islamic extremism very easily breeds, and that's where it comes from. So it starts from, again, alienation, these creation of states within states that's hostile to the authority, and then those elements very easily develop into radical Islam.
And also we've heard a lot about the sort of the competition between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that basically, you know, may have added to all that's going on in France?
Sure. A lot of interesting developments have happened on that front. ISIS used to be the Iraqi branch of Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda was getting upset with them because they were really bad for Al-Qaeda's image because they kept massacring Muslims left and right. And unsurprisingly, Muslims didn't quite like that. And so bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current chief of Al-Qaeda, was telling their branch in Iraq that you've got to rein this in. If you commit a beheading, don't put it on videotape. You've got to just act a little bit more sane and not be so reckless. And they rejected it, and they just kept doing it. And to just kind of summarize the story, what this led to is that Al-Qaeda in Iraq ended up having a rivalry with Al-Qaeda in Syria. They started going back and forth. The Al-Qaeda leadership intervened. Al-Qaeda in Iraq didn't like the resolution, and so they left. They essentially just started doing things on their own, and then Al-Qaeda formally kicked them out, and then they began competing. The Islamic State, ISIS, started winning that competition because of how they were able to recruit so many people because of their success, and they started overshadowing Al-Qaeda. So what makes this attack in Paris so significant is that ISIS's attacks on the West were largely just radicalizing some psychopath or someone who is mentally unstable in some cases, and not most of them, but in some, and they would carry out an attack on their own. What Al-Qaeda was able to do with their branch in Yemen was apparently train and dispatch operatives, actually make this attack the result of a trained, orchestrated network, and become more successful than ISIS. So that raises the pressure on ISIS to outdo them, and so that's why there's something I call the Jihadist Olympics right now, where they're each trying to get the gold medal by outdoing each other, and it looked like Al-Qaeda was on its way out in terms of prestige, but now they just ran forward, sprinted forward, and now they're number one. In recent days, well, the most interesting development was the fact that the two brothers were linked to Al-Qaeda, but then the individual who went and took over the grocery store, it turns out he's a member of ISIS. So how does that make sense in the context of what I just explained? These two groups are competing, their rivalry, and here's the answer. I don't believe that the leadership of Al-Qaeda and ISIS knew that they had members of the other group involved in their plots. What looks to me is that these Al-Qaeda members and this ISIS supporter came across each other, decided that it was petty and stupid for how these groups were competing with each other and not working together, and so on an individual level, they decided to carry out this joint attack. And what's extremely dangerous about that is that that could spark a trend where even if the leaders of these groups are fighting back and forth, the members will start fusing together because they now have an example of success that they can follow in and inspire them to do that.
And that's kind of like what you see in a lot of different things, that where groups are, they have sort of the same goal, and even though they don't necessarily like each other, sometimes they do start working together, and it becomes very dangerous at that point because it's very hard to sort of tell what's going to happen down the road and what exactly what their actions are going to be. So that's going to make it more difficult for our intelligence, I would think.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Now, also, we had the 4 million people marching in Paris and over the weekend, and notably, you know, our president wasn't there. So what kind of message does that send to, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda?
I'm not sure that it does send a message, actually. And that's because the way Al-Qaeda and ISIS view us is kind of set in stone, so I'm not sure that his absence makes us less safe. The optics are terrible, absolutely terrible for us. The different feelings I have about it is that, on the one hand, when I was on Fox real early this morning, Peter Ducey reported that he heard from White House officials. They were trying to say, well, President Obama and Vice President Biden couldn't go because they have such a large security detail that it would complicate the march and it would distract from it. And I think that's a load of baloney. And the reason I think that is because you have 40 world leaders there who also somehow said, okay, well, we feel safe enough going and we don't have to have this monstrous security detail. And you're actually safer being there because you don't not only have the American detail, you have the details of all these other world leaders. And if there was any chance that they felt unsafe, they wouldn't go. So I think Obama could have reduced the size of his security detail and I think have been fine. And especially when you're commander in chief, for something like that, maybe you take a little bit more risk, especially when you're sending in soldiers who don't have a protective security detail into war in places like Afghanistan. You know, show a little guts here. But the only explanation that makes sense beyond that, what I think is a deception, is that some folks were saying that maybe it's because President Obama was worried that the French were going to characterize this march as being a march against radical Islam, and he didn't want any part of that. And that seems to be the only explanation that makes sense. It makes sense why the White House would be so evasive about it. It makes sense why President Obama would shockingly not go. And it makes sense as to why the White House had just horrible messaging today when a reporter asked the spokesperson about it, and he said he didn't know. He actually said on air, he said he didn't know why President Obama wasn't there. He didn't have a good answer. So they're not on the same page, which indicates that what the White House told Fox News earlier this morning, that those officials were probably just trying to spin it on their own. And it means that there's another reason for this, and I think that's the best reason.
Yeah, as Josh Earnest, again, the White House press secretary, was talking, I know Ed Henry from Fox News was trying to, you know, ask him those questions. Why wasn't Obama there? And every excuse, of course, was just like you said, you know, the detail was too big and we couldn't do it that quickly, blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, you know, Netanyahu was there. And then after that, it was kind of like, well, really what it was, too, was we wanted the common man to be able to walk in this this march. And we knew if Obama was there, you know, they wouldn't be able to do that. So, you know, it was a lot
no
of
sense.
Importance. Please. No, it makes no sense at all. My theory is a little bit different. I think part of why he didn't go is I believe that he's more of a globalist. And, you know, you can't be a globalist if you're sort of pinpointing one group that you don't like. So if you show up against something, then you can't later, you know, kind of turn around and welcome them. And you know, if you're trying to do something on a global scale, you don't want to make people mad.
I think
you go on an apology tour.
Sure. I think President Obama views Al-Qaeda and ISIS as irreconcilable elements of this global order. And what I mean by global order, I mean the international community as a whole. And that's why he views the Muslim Brotherhood as being moderate and these other groups, because he can see them cooperating within an international system construct where all of the countries kind of work together. They're folks that you can deal with. But Al-Qaeda and ISIS, there's no way for them to fit into the order, and so that's why President Obama says, well, then they need to be destroyed, because President Obama is even willing to accept the Taliban into the political structure of Afghanistan. He's willing to negotiate with them. Why? Because he may not like them, but he sees them as folks that you can deal with. But he knows you can't deal with Al-Qaeda and ISIS because they're the most radical of the radical elements. So I'm not sure how that plays into how you see things. I mean, but the bottom line is that we don't know, and that there should be a really easy explanation for this. And I don't know how the White House spokesperson wasn't briefed by someone beforehand, because they had to know this question was going to come up.
Right. Well, and it seems odd, too, that if he feels that way about ISIS and Al-Qaeda, why doesn't he call it radical, you know, Islam or radicalized extremists, something? You know, I mean, I know he doesn't want to go against the religion, but we're not talking about that when we're talking about these groups. We're talking about people who commit, you know, terrorism. And it would just seem to be so easy to say, you know, even call them radical terrorists, something, give us something. But, you know, he doesn't seem to want to do that.
If he wants to focus solely on the irreconcilables, as he views them, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, it makes sense why he wouldn't want to say the war on radical Islam, because that broadens out the conflict. Consistently, what we've seen since President Obama took office is that he's wanted to narrow down the conflict as much as possible. And to the point where he gave a speech where my jaw dropped, and I couldn't believe that also other people didn't pick up on it, where he said that not all Al-Qaeda affiliates should be treated as a number one threat, and not every collection of people who call themselves Al-Qaeda are worthy of the same attention. So for him, even parts of Al-Qaeda don't need to be part of our focus, really. So he wants the conflict to be as narrow as possible, whereas if you call it a war on radical Islam, you broaden it out. I think it's necessary to broaden it out, and that's just the reality. And I think the majority of the world now agrees with me. It used to make sense to argue, well, we don't want to call it war on radical Islam because how that would be perceived in the Muslim world. Our allies in Europe don't like it. Well, Europe is now using that terminology. We're seeing Muslim leaders in the Arab world using that terminology. The only ones who aren't using that terminology is us.
Right, exactly. Let's go back a little bit to what you talked about earlier about the call in Egypt and Tunisia, I believe, that asking for a modification. Go a little bit more in depth in that, if you will.
Sure. This is really, really significant and amazing. And I'm glad that the El-Sisi speech, that's the president of Egypt, is getting the attention that it deserves. But I still think people don't know the full extent of it, because it takes a little bit to explain. We talked about earlier about the need to modernize Islam and to reject old interpretations and look at this with a set of fresh new eyes. And the anti-Muslim Brotherhood, anti-Islamist leader of Egypt, El-Sisi, has been saying for at least the past year, that Islamist parties as part of reforming the Muslim world cannot be allowed into the political system. You should not have parties based on ethnicity or religion, because that means you're excluding another part of society. That makes sense. And he's saying that the enemy is political Islam or Islamism. He's not afraid of saying that. And he says that they don't represent Islam. Even though the terminology sounds the same, you can't fuse those two. And so his solution to all of this is a societal transformation in Egypt and the Muslim world, where you rip apart mosque and state. And in his speech on Muhammad's birthday, the Prophet Muhammad's birthday, he went to Al-Azhar University, which is the closest thing that Islam has to the Vatican. And he starts talking about the need to revise religious discourse. And he didn't blame the West or Israel for any of the problems in the Muslim world. He says the Muslim world has become a source of aggression towards the rest of the world. That statement alone is huge, because usually they blame it on colonialism or anything else. Excuse making here. And then he starts talking about the need for a reformation. He starts kind of detailing it. But the moment that it's just so remarkable, and it could go down in history in textbooks one day, is when he turns and the general in him snaps on, and he looks at the leader of Al-Azhar University, again, essentially Islam's Vatican, the Pope, and he says, Allah needs us, for the sake of Islam and Muslims, to revise our interpretations. And then he calls him out by name, and he says, Allah is watching you, the country is watching you, the whole world is watching you. And then he just lets it be silent for a couple seconds.
Wow.
I mean that's unbelievable.
I know. It's amazing he's still here with us at that point.
It's because the Egyptian people love him.
Mm-hmm. And do you really think that those people that are really so entrenched in this, that they will sort of change their ways, that just having him say that, you know, is enough to make people go, oh, you're right. Yeah, we need to really kind of look at this. I mean, they've been doing this, 800 years?
Right, and here's the thing. People are talking about, well, there's going to be a backlash among Islamists and then among Muslims who feel that that was an offensive thing to say. The backlash is good because it starts the discourse. It starts the debate about whether you should reinterpret your faith and modernize it, which is a debate that hasn't even begun yet and is the most difficult stumbling block for such a thing to happen. So by doing something a little bit provocative like that, he guaranteed that intellectual battle will now begin. And the same thing's happening in Tunisia, which isn't getting any coverage and is arguably more significant because that government was actually elected. The president of Egypt was technically elected. There's some people that question the authenticity of the election, but the military stepped in. They overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood. So some people say it's a coup. In Tunisia, you can't make that argument. The secular Democrat Muslims that are calling for separating mosque and state came in electorally. They were voted in. So there's no way that their enemies can spin it as being illegitimate or them deceiving. When they were campaigning, they were saying, look, we're the ones that stopped Sharia from being in the Constitution. That's why you should vote for us. And the people voted for them. And so you have both in Tunisia and Egypt, the first two countries to experience the Arab Spring are now firmly in the anti-Islamist camp after they were originally taken over by Islamists.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. I had a long time listener kind of ask me earlier today. You know, we always say that the United States is fighting the war and is, you know, ISIS and all that. Who's helping? Who are our allies in this? Is anybody helping us? And how are we really fighting this?
I'm not sure why commentators keep saying that we're going it alone, because it's so patently false. We had over 50 countries that were part of the coalition to go into Iraq and Syria to fight ISIS. Every single Muslim organization of any significance, even the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, have condemned ISIS. I see commentators saying that Muslims need to condemn them. Even groups that are radical here in the U.S. that I criticize have condemned ISIS. It's just patently false. Everyone has condemned them. In terms of the military effort, you have a lot of countries that are involved, several Arab countries, actually. The UAE had a female pilot that was bombing ISIS, which is symbolically extremely significant in that part of the world. Right. Mm-hmm. And we have a ton of allies in terms of the Iraqi security forces on the ground, the Kurds. We're trying to ally with some Syrian rebels, but that's not going so well for various reasons. So this is an international effort. We're leading it. We have allies involved. But for some reason, I guess the American public always wants more allies involved so that we have to do less, which I completely understand. And I would like the world to do more. But the commentators that are making it sound like this is the U.S. going it alone, it's just the facts don't substantiate that.
Well, it looks like we have a caller on the line with a question. Are you open to taking questions now?
Sure.
Okay, let me bring them on. Welcome to the show. Hello?
Word is not defined yet on how.
So I guess they're not there. They're holding
it's
on the
all
line
right.
And not listening. My other question for you is, today's hack against the hacking against the U.S. Central Command. What's your insight on that, and what do you feel is coming on that?
Well, first of all, if anyone wants to type into the – I think you have a chat room. If they want to type in a question,
right.
That's probably preferable, for vetting and, that sort of thing. But
right.
As for the hacking attack, that's really remarkable. I mean, they didn't hack into these, as far as we know, these sensitive computer databases and get weapon secrets. But nonetheless, hacking into the social media of the U.S. military and then posting personal information of military personnel – that means that they were still able to get into something sensitive enough. It wasn't just
right.
some kid hackers going in and defacing a website. They actually went into – it was a coordinated attack. They went into the YouTube, into Twitter. The accounts had to get shut down. They had the material ready to upload. And somehow in the midst of that, they were able to get that personal information. And that's what I'm really concerned about, because – that personal information, I don't see why that would be available in Facebook or in Twitter. That means that they must have
right.
gone into some server somewhere, or someone's email address, and that's what we need to be focusing on. That's more important than the
mm-hmm.
social media hacking, even though they should be able to hack into anything at all run by the military.
Right. And then we had pictures posted and then threats made against the military, about watch your back, ISIS is coming, and things like that. So,
that's the type of thing that they say constantly. So I wouldn't consider that mm-hmm. a new and imminent threat. It could result in an attack, but it would probably be an attack that was going to happen anyway, because this isn't a new call to action.
And what can, Europe expect? I know that there's been a warning by the British intelligence that, that ISIS is coming to Europe. I mean, what more can we expect?
Expect more incidents like what happened in Paris, unfortunately. Europe is a very vulnerable target. They have the terrorists, if they invested more money and more time into recruiting within Europe sleeper cells, they could be very successful. You have countries like Qatar, which is a supposed ally of the U.S., but they're not, still promoting the Islamist ideology in Europe, building mosques, which creates the next generation of extremists and kind of sets the foundation for all of this. So the future does not look good. And one of the things I'm really concerned about in the short term is that if there's an anti-Muslim group of activists in Europe, or even worse, a movement, that then starts treating the Muslims collectively and trying to throw them out of Europe or closing down all the mosques, and they cross that line from talking about a specific Islamic ideology and then they just go after every Muslim everywhere, that's going to play right into Al-Qaeda's hands, and that's going to be a bigger success for them than the Paris attack itself, because that creates
mm-hmm.
a long-term trend that they can play off of and survive from and get a lot of recruits from.
And then when we were talking about the hacking, and just sort of as a side, do you want to mention the North Korea attack and kind of what you're doing in those terms of that, if you're still doing
oh, right.
your campaign on it?
Oh, definitely. North Korea is not separate from the battle against jihad, even though it's a communist, atheist state officially. And that's because Iran has, it appears, outsourced their nuclear program to North Korea. Every single time North Korea does a major missile test or a nuclear test or anything, there's always these reports of Iranian scientists there. And North Korea doesn't have a lot of money for this. So where are they getting the money from? They're probably getting it from the Iranians. We know that they sell weapons back and forth. We know North Korea has helped with tunnel construction with Hezbollah, which was very, very powerful, and then that was probably transferred to Hamas either by Hezbollah as a proxy or North Korea directly. So they're part of the battle against the jihadist ideology, And that needs to be recognized, that the North Korean WMD program is the exact same thing as the Iranian program. You have to go after both of them. And in addition, North Korea, obviously, human rights disaster, tens of thousands of Christians in concentration camps. So what do we do about this? And there is something that every listener can and should do, and they can do it for as little as $5. You can go to hackthemback.com, hackthemback.com, and make a donation to this group that's working with North Korean defectors and South Korean freedom fighters to send in balloons and land smuggling materials into North Korea that break the Kim Jong-un myth, all of the propaganda, and awaken these people to the cult that they've been living in for decades now. And we know from North Koreans who have escaped that this stuff is very, very powerful, because the only reason the regime survives is because of the information blockade. And so for the cost of a beer, you can send in a DVD that awakens someone from a cult. I mean, that's an amazing investment.
And give that website again.
Sure. It's hackthemback.com. And definitely email me if you make a donation, because I'd just like to keep track of that and just be able to show that, you know, people care, you know, that people are willing to do these type of measures. They just need specific instruction beyond, oh, read about it and talk about it and educate yourself. This is one of those times you can do something very substantive, be a part of history, help bring down this regime, and really – quite almost directly save people's lives. I mean, we think about how when we hear about World War II, it's always like, well, never again. We'll never let that happen again. Well, it's happening, so do something.
And what's your email address for them to get in touch with you?
Sure. It's ryan@clarionproject.org. And I want to emphasize that that program is not something run or affiliated with me. It's just something that I see such value in that I want people to know about it and support. And I've personally supported as much as I can with what little I have.
No, it sounds like a great idea. We should probably do it on all the countries, as a matter of fact. Just keep dropping things to educate more and more people. In looking at things in this administration, what has a jihadist learned about America?
Well, the positive thing that they've learned is that our influence is going to keep spreading no matter what they do. And that's just because of globalization, and that the American people, hopefully that this North Korea initiative is an example of that, that the American people are willing to take action even when their leaders are not. When it comes to the drone strike and the airstrikes against ISIS, we are showing that we're strong and that there are limits to how far you can push us. But on the other hand, we are looking a bit ignorant. We're looking weak. We're not able to pick allies and pick friends correctly. And so for Islamists and jihadists around the world, I think they look at the U.S. right now, and that idea of America as a paper tiger is being reinforced, particularly, again, by the self-censorship. That was the objective of the attack in Paris. And you had more people in Paris, in France, publishing the cartoon than you had in America. America was the one that acted weak. And every outlet was censoring the cartoons in America, even though it was France that was attacked. I mean, terrorists notice things like that, and that's how they judge success. And that's when, if you're a jihadist donor, you're going to say, "I want to donate to the guys that achieve that objective." It really helps them.
And what does it do when you have the president coming out and after this attack and saying, "Gosh, we're gonna teach people about, Islamophobia, and we'll get the classes together and all that." I mean, what impression does that leave on people who are there to do us harm?
That we're afraid, because the jihadist ideology and their propaganda is that they are responding to Islamophobia. Everything that they do that's an offensive attack, they characterize as defensive, because they say that there's a war on Islam, that the West hates Muslims. And so when President Obama or any other Western official gets up there and says, "We have a serious problem with Islamophobia and we need to counter it," what they're saying is that part of the jihadist worldview is correct. And it reinforces their propaganda. It really plays a role in the radicalization process and helping them to recruit. And it's something that we should be fighting against. There is a place for fighting against anti-Muslim sentiment in order to debunk the propaganda. But when you start saying that there's a major problem with Islamophobia, And you don't couple that with saying, but there's also a problem with the Islamist ideology. When you're favoring one side over the other that way, that advances the Al-Qaeda worldview and the conspiracy theorism that it permeates throughout the Middle East that helps create the problem.
And we've talked about a couple of, you know, what are some of the, like the top five, if you will, of the best steps to stop radical Islam extremists?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of the five all at once, but so I'll just see how many I can come up with on a short notice. How about that?
Okay, that's good.
The first thing is to shift the framework of our foreign policy. Readopt democracy promotion and promoting our values. It doesn't mean you have to go to war and nation build, but there's a huge role for soft power to be played on the Cold War model that was very successful. And it's a lot cheaper than war, too. So adopt that as your model. Secondly, as a subset of that model, you have to identify the Islamist ideology or political Islam or Islamic extremism, whatever you want to call it. There has to be a focus on this battle within the Islamic world between those that want to separate mosque and state and those that view the faith as a political doctrine and want to combine the two. If we don't frame it that way, we can't pick the proper allies and develop a correct strategy. The next thing that I would do is develop direct relations with any type of Muslim or non-Muslim activist group in the Muslim world that's pushing for this reformation and pushing for human rights. And you develop that relationship by having your ambassador or someone close to them directly manage that relationship and simply saying, what can we do to help you, and then doing it. As far as I know, those conversations aren't even taking place. In some cases, it'll be money, it'll be supplies. Most of the time, it's just going to be political support. But those conversations are not taking place because that's not part of the strategic framework. In terms of immigration and combating the ideology, we need to delegitimize groups like the Council on American Islamic Relations, a group that may be nonviolent in the U.S. but is still linked to the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas and advances a lot of their propaganda. And the way you delegitimize them is by bringing up alternatives. They only represent something like 12% of the Muslim American community, so don't treat them like your spokesperson. Diversify the number of Muslims that you're working with. And then, obviously, there's various security measures that we can do. Secure the borders, more tightly screen who we're letting into the country, I would say on an ideological basis. If they display anti-Americanism or radicalism of any kind, don't let them in. And if they're here and they express it, then you kick them out.
Right. And that's going to be hard to do. I mean, as we know, we have a president that, you know, doesn't go along with those type of policies. And it's going to be interesting to see if there is a person who, you know, actually stands up and starts sort of, you know, spearheading the United States in the right direction on the things that you've just spoken about.
There's a lot of rhetoric. Well, that's one of the things that when the presidential contest begins on both sides, I want to urge everyone to look beyond the rhetoric and see if they actually have a plan, a very specific plan, where they can give examples. Because most of the time they can't. Usually it's all based on poll-tested words that resonate with audiences.
Well, and I tell you, the subject, it's great to have someone like you on the show who really is an expert at this, because there's just so much going on and so much that we have to look at that, you know, we need someone like you to pull this all together. And, you know, I'm really glad that you were able to come on tonight, and I want everybody to, you know, continue watching you on Spock and go to your website, theclarionproject.org, and get a lot of information there. And it's something where we really need to keep looking at this. We really need to get the word out and make everyone aware of what's going on.
Yeah, and thanks so much for having me. I encourage everyone to sign up for our weekly newsletter at clarionproject.org so we can keep in contact with you and be part of what we're trying to do to stop this.
Well, and absolutely. So everybody, please go and do that. And Ryan, again, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a great one. So as you heard it from him, we have a lot to do and a lot to, you know, sort of keep abreast of all the changes that are going on. It was great to have him on tonight. Do go check out his website. I think you'll learn a lot on that website, a lot of news that comes up every day. And again, he has been on, he's been on Fox News almost every day, and he also has a lot of YouTube videos that you can go and find Again, it's Ryan Morrow, M-A-U-R-O. So I hope everybody is back here again next week. We have another incredible guest next week on a subject that is just going to absolutely blow your mind. So please tell all of your guests, your friends, to be back next week and join us. And I certainly would love to hear from you. Go to my website at SusanKnowles.com, and you can reach me at Susan@SusanKnowles.com, and the Knowles is spelled K-N-O-W-L-E-S. Until next week, have a great week, and God bless.